The task we've set ourselves in Socialist Alternative is to attempt to build a mass revolutionary workers' party that can eventually lead a struggle for the revolutionary transformation of Australian society. And how do we propose to achieve that? Well, we start out by building what, sort of in the parlance of Marxist approach to party building, a propaganda group. A propaganda group, in other words, a core of people wedded to Marxist ideas who attempt to group around them a bigger layer of people we call cadre that have understanding of the politics and in turn can lay the basis of that political understanding with clear-cut revolutionary politics, lay the basis for a mass working-class party. And initially, we expect, that's our orientation, that we'll predominantly recruit, it'll be younger people, often students and that. But then in turn, once we've achieved something approaching a critical mass, and in the framework of circumstances of radicalisation, when there's real opportunities to break into the working class, actually we can achieve that. We can go from being a group of hundreds or a few thousands, predominantly people outside the working class, to achieve a real critical mass inside the working class and be really able to relate to working class struggles. Now, that's the task we've set ourselves. Now, we can, of course, provide no guarantees that we're going to be able to achieve this. And for many people, even people that might be convinced of the ideas of socialism, it can seem, when you look around you, to go through a group of a few hundred to a party, to actually lead the working class in power. In Australia, we're talking about a party of hundreds of thousands of members. Actually, that can seem a pretty daunting prospect. But actually, and one of the reasons having this talk is I want to look at a few and centre on the Polish example about how this was achieved, but put this in certain contexts, is that the task we've set itself and the orientation we've set itself is nothing new, nothing particularly historically original in the socialist movement. The most classic example was the emergence of Marxism in Russia, where a tiny core of people, a handful, literally, around Plekhanov in Russia, laid the theoretical foundations of Marxism, a series of polemics against the dominant political tradition at the time in Russia, radical populist ideas. Actually, they chipped away, they argued, they laid the basis of undermining populism, starting to establish the intellectual authority of Marxism. And then, at a later period, a decade or so later, as the political climate started to shift, as the balance of forces on the left moved, as the workers moved into struggle, actually, they laid the basis, first, to go from a group of a half a dozen or so to win a degree of hegemony amongst the left wing of the intelligentsia and amongst students, and then, in turn, actually laid the basis for winning over a whole layer of working-class people. But it was not just in Russia that this experience was repeated. In China in the early 1920s, a few hundred of predominantly very young students in this course of very radical times of a mass revolutionary wave sweeping through China and so on, actually from the start of the 1920s with a few hundred members at the most, actually by 1925, 26, they were leading a massive working class party with tens and tens of thousands of members that actually were able to participate in a huge revolutionary wave. And this pattern was again replicated in the 1940s in Sri Lanka by a small handful of Trotskyists there who'd been won to Marxist ideas while studying in Britain. And I'm not going to go through example after example, except to say that, these examples don't guarantee anything. Actually, they show that the project is possible. And, in relates to other discussions we were having over Marxism, actually shows that, this road has laid the basis, where all sorts of other alternatives put forward have not laid the basis for a mass working class party. Okay, in this case, I'm going to talk about the emergence of Marxism in Poland, a fairly little-known example in many ways, but I think a quite dramatic one. because it is quite, you know, a very good illustration of what a small core of dedicated Marxists who were firm on their political principles, who, you know, stood out and fought for their ideas, were prepared to make a real stand and be dedicated and, you know, really commit themselves, were able to achieve when the climate changed politically to their advantage. Okay, well, the socialist movement, in the broader sense of the word, first emerges in Poland in the 1870s. Poland then was divided between a series of countries. A whole chunk of Poland was under the occupation of the Tsarist Empire. But Poland was the most industrially advanced part of the Tsarist Empire. And so it was no accident that the socialist movement emerged there first, and where a strong labour movement began to arise. The late 19th century, you know, saw the emergence of two currents inside the socialist movement. On one hand, there was a larger current, a reformist current, which eventually cohered as the Polish Socialist Party, the PPS. And if people get lost in the initials, there's a lot of alphabet soups come through this, but just interrupt if you do. That they became the main current in Polish socialism. And this reformist current set their first task as being as winning national independence for Poland. So they were a nationalist, reformist organisation, and for them, you know, the idea of socialism was something to come, well, at some distant point in the future, after Poland had achieved its national independence. The other current was a Marxist current that was looked to the working class for its deliberate self-emancipation, looked to form alliances with working class movements in the rest of the Tsarist Empire, and was hostile to Polish nationalism. And that coalesced as the Social Democrat, the Marxist wing of the movement, coalesced as the Social Democratic Party of the Kingdom of Poland. And it formed in 1893. It quickly grew to about 400 members, predominantly students, but the wave after wave of police repression in the middle of the 1890s essentially eliminated it from the political scene by 1895. Now, two of the key leaders of the Polish Marxists were two of the most famous revolutionaries of the period, Rosa Luxemburg and Leo Jogosz. They then went into exile. They remained very important intellectual figures in the Marxist movement in Poland. But really, from then on, they didn't play this important role on the ground, in building the Marxist movement on the ground. Now, but as I said, they set the theoretical tone, and the theoretical tone was one of strident opposition to Polish nationalism. And in many ways, that became the defining political emphasis of the party, you know, the pounding and pounding away against the ideas of Polish nationalism, arguing for unity with the working class movement throughout the empire and so on. And that's what set them apart against their reformist rivals in the PPS. And allied to that, their publications were noted for a very sharp polemical tone. This was not polite publication. And in turn, that flowed through outside Poland itself to bitter polemics with Lenin and in Russia, because Lenin supported the right of national self-determination for the Poles, which Luxemburg and co. opposed. And it also led them to the Polish Marxists to walk out of the founding conference of the Russian Social Democratic Movement over this question. Now, the American Marxist, Paul Draper, argues on the basis of this, he writes, her, i.e. Rosa Luxemburg's, Polish comrades established a sect, not a class party. And indeed, the SDKP was very much an organisation that, in Draper's words, made, quote, a special set of views the determinant of its organisational form. But I'd argue that Draper is totally wrong in this characterisation of the Polish Marxists. It was true, they had the wrong position on Polish nationalism, and they were quite sectarian about it. They had a whole series of other political positions which they were wrong about, But fundamentally, they held to a revolutionary perspective, which was able to penetrate the working class. And actually, during the course of the 1905 revolution in Poland, they built a much larger revolutionary party than the Bolsheviks were able to accomplish in Russia itself, and distinctively with a much larger working class following. Okay. And one of the people I want to concentrate in how they achieved this is the person that became the main leader of the party on the ground, Felix Dzerzhinsky. Now, Luxembourg and Jogisic are much more famous. They did much more to establish the theoretical and political traditions of Polish Marxism. But actually, when it came to building on the ground, Dzerzhinsky was the decisive element. Dzerzhinsky himself was a Polish background, but he'd been born in the neighbouring area of Lithuania. He became active as a socialist, was a Marxist, while at high schools. And by the age of 18, he was leading his own grouping inside Lithuania in his school. And he was became one of the leading figures in the Lithuanian Social Democratic Party. Dzerzhinsky, however, was nothing of a theoretician to rival Luxembourg. As one of the other leading Polish Marxists wrote of him, and I'd like to excuse if some of the pronunciation's wrong, if anybody's Polish here and correct me with some of them, fine. Anyhow, Adolf Worski wrote, "Ideas for Dzerzhinsky existed in order to translate them into action, in order to fight for them, in order to bring them to life." And he was then, you know, the master underground political operative and so on. At an early age, in 1897, in July, he was arrested and deported to Siberia. This was to be the first of many, 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 many arrests. And very soon, it was also to be the first of many, many, many escapes from arrest. He got out of Siberia, fled, and eventually got back to his homeland. But by then, the Lithuanian Social Democrats had been broken up by quite severe police repression. So he moved on. He went to Warsaw, the capital of Poland, and there as well, the Marxist movement had been shattered by repression. And he looked around and thought, I'm not going to talk about, I think I've mentioned it aside. There was another Marxist current in the Bund, the Jewish Social Democratic Movement, which at times he allied with, but he couldn't join them. And the Marxists had been shattered in Warsaw, so he joined the PPS as an area to operate in. But this was a straight-out entry job. I mean, Dzerzhinsky had nothing but seething contempt for the reformist and nationalist politics of the Polish Socialist Party. And he attacked the leadership of the PPS for their nationalism, for their downplaying of working class organisation and working class demands, and he quickly established himself a base. First amongst artisan workers, people you wouldn't think of today. He built a base amongst bakers, shoemakers and hairdressers. And by November 1899, he'd organised about 200 of these workers into Marxist propaganda circles. And in turn, out of that, he carried through an amalgamation of what was the remnants of the Polish Social Democrats and the Lithuanian Social Democrats to form another alphabet soup group called the Social Democratic Party of the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania, SDKPIL. Okay. By February 1900, he was arrested yet again. But by this time, he'd actually cohered around him a dedicated circle of young activists who were able to maintain the organisation after he went into prison. And this is a very young organisation. Well over half the members were under the age of 25. But as I said, he cohered a layer of people versed in the politics and determined and provided an ongoing core, which meant that the organisation actually continued to grow for a period despite him being in jail. And by the early years of 1901, the early part of 1901, it had about 1,000 members. Siberian this time managed to contain him for 2 years before he escaped. But by then, the SDKPIL was in the flux of major internal disputes, and there'd been a further wave of savage police repression, which was weakening it. He immediately went into exile, you know, linked up with Jogishish and Luxembourg in exile, you know, where they debated out what to do, and so on. But he quickly re-established his authority in the organisation and started to rebuild. This time, he made his base in the Austrian part of Poland, that the Austria also controlled part of Poland. There, the scale of police repression wasn't severe, and he started to build up from there a series of agents that would smuggle political literature and so on into the Tsarist part of Poland. Now, this period, in these next few years, were a time of quite great ferment amongst young people in Poland, particularly amongst high school students and amongst university students. And it was there that amongst very highly politicised layers amongst young people that the Marxists started to build up their forces. And this was the period leading up to the 1904 war between Russia and Japan, which was quite to have very decisive ramifications for the whole of the Tsarist Empire, but in particular for Poland. Now, for both the reformists of the PPS and of the SDKPIL, the overwhelming majority of their activists were students or ex-students. This gives a feel, One of the historians recorded, of the 56 persons arrested in a Warsaw demonstration organised by the SDKPIL in May 1904, so out of that 56, 34 were students or former students, and only two could be classified as workers. The entire Southern Committee of the party consisted of students from the Institute of Agriculture and Forestry, not what you'd normally expect a revolutionary centre. And by the start of 1904, the SDKPIL had about 125 to 150 members in the capital, Warsaw, loosely organised in propaganda circles. And if you think that today, well, it's actually pretty similar size to our membership in Melbourne. Their reformist rival at the time was about five times larger. But the Marxists had one decisive advantage over them, even though they were a fifth the size, and that was they were much clearer and cohered politically. Much greater ideological unity. Dzerzhinsky now set about to cohere and better organise what was had been pretty loose propaganda circles into much more a disciplined, cohesive underground nucleus. One of the first things he had to do was actually politically cohere people on the basis of the question of terrorism. A number of members who supported terrorism were expelled. He now developed, as I was starting to talk about earlier, quite an elaborate system of agents and underground political operatives. And this meant, and the growth that went with this, meant they were well placed to intervene when the wave of revolt that swept through Poland and through the whole of the Tsarist Empire in the wake of Russia's defeats suffered in the war with Japan in 1905. The outbreak of the war between Russia and Japan led to an economic crisis throughout the empire. You know, inflation soared, there was widespread unemployment, and that in turn also bred discontent. And in this context, the reformist PPS split. Immediately the war was declared, the mainstream leadership of the reformers immediately sent a delegation headed by their leader, Pilsudski. He went to Tokyo to try to form an alliance. Well, he did form an alliance with the Japanese government that his armed militia would fight on the side of Japan in the war. But back in Poland itself, the younger youthful elements in the PPS actually were more oriented to working-class struggle and were not as extremely nationalist. And so that started to open up in the space, actually, for the Marxists to intervene, to try to win over some of the elements from the Reformist Party. And by the end of 1904, the proportions between the organisations were narrowing. By then, the Marxists were about two-thirds the size of the Reformist organisation. So the balance of forces were changing. On the other hand, though, the leadership of the SDKPAL did not let up on any of its a polemical assault on the Reformers. And indeed, I think you could argue, in terms of their relationship to the left wing of the PPS, at that stage they had quite a sectarian organisation to it. Then came the Bloody Sunday massacre in St. Petersburg, which really starts to when the Tsarist authorities fired on and massacring workers marching to demand democratic reforms in Russia itself. And that in turn provoked a wave of revolt. And it reached its greatest intensity in Poland. A general strike soon erupted in Warsaw, and this struggle really reached a fever pitch. The SDKPIL burst into activity and very rapidly gained a prominence in these working class struggles. It also backed the mass student campaign, which was of truly tremendous proportions, which was demanding Polish national rights. And here was a potentially, you know, contradiction and a very an opportunity, but a dangerous one in many ways for the Polish Marxists, because they'd staked their theoretical stance and their polemics on this bitter opposition to Polish nationalism. And here you have a massive student movement of, you know, mobilising just the whole of the student population. Here I'm talking about high school students and university students demanding Polish national rights, you know, against the terrible oppression the Polish people were suffering under Tsarist domination. But Dzerzhinsky managed to carry out a shift in their political orientation. So rather than directly counterposing themselves to this movement, would have actually probably shattered their own organisation. They now shifted their orientation. They called for the equality of nations in the Tsarist Empire with freedom of cultural development, for national schools and for national autonomy for Poland, which is something of a fudge, because exactly what does national autonomy mean vis-à-vis national independence? But this shift, at least, even though there were some theoretical weaknesses in it, actually meant that they were able to relate to this huge movement that was breaking through. So the Polish Marxists were able to take a more nuanced position on the national question than you might have expected in advance. Dzerzhinsky also now shifted to attempt to moderate some of the tone of the polemics against the left wing of the PPS. And so in the course of this revolutionary wave, actually some of the sectarian edges were beginning to be taken off the organisation. Though not all. And that is particularly on the trade union question. Because the only trade unions that the SDKPIL would support were unions in which all the members had to be members of the party. And this position seems to have come directly from Rosa Luxemburg herself, who seemed to have concluded from the experience of having to fight the Reformist trade union leaders in Germany that any trade union movement with Reformists in it, at the either bunch rank and file or in the leadership, was doomed to be a reactionary obstacle to the class struggle. So the only unions accepted were to be ones members of the Revolutionary Party. Now, the politicisation at the high point of the struggle, actually, this didn't particularly get in the road to start with, because they were recruiting workers in mass numbers, and you know, you're an underground organisation, even though the things are breaking open, it's not the mass of workers that are joining. So at the height of the struggle, this position, although wrong, didn't necessarily have this disastrous impact. But later on, as the movement went into retreat, actually, this was not a good position to have. Okay. In the first months of 1905, with this revolution breaking out everywhere, this you know, lean, conspiratorial organization was facing all sorts of challenges. As Jasinski said himself, as they attempted to respond to the mass movement, they were in danger of losing their heads, and their heads were bursting open. He now called for greater local autonomy for the party organizations on the ground. The party's resources were being overwhelmed by the huge surge of membership. There was not enough trained leaders and agitators. There was not enough revolutionary literature. And as Jasinski, you know, howled at the time, absolutely everyone is exhausted. And the newness of the organization inevitably led to mistakes. At times, the SDKPIL membership succumbed to pressure for premature actions. In one case, students in the south of Poland encouraged an armed uprising by rank-and-file soldiers. That was, you know, clearly not on the agenda at the time. Nonetheless, the party had genuine vitality. And despite large-scale arrests, in particular of leading activists, in March 1905, it was able to recover from these setbacks and continue to grow. And on May Day 1905 in Warsaw, the SDKPIL organised its own contingent, which was 30,000 strong, through the streets of Warsaw. The army opened fire on them, and 50 were killed immediately and 100 wounded. In response to this, the SDKPIL called for a general strike, but it flopped. And in exile, Luxembourg and Jogisches were becoming worried now that the party was moving on an adventurous course, which would end in disaster. But Jasinski went into conference with them. They managed to reorient and settle down to, you know, a more nuanced orientation, if you like. While this going on, the leadership had to break out of the conspiratorial cover they'd been used to operating in and become public figures in the mass movement. And that, in turn, of course, led to more arrests, including the arrest of Jasinski himself and the whole of the Warsaw leadership. Nevertheless, despite all this, by getting towards the end of 1906, they had grown to 40,000 members, only slightly smaller than the reformist PPS. So in the space of 3 short years of quite climactic struggles, they'd gone from a small propaganda group of at best a couple of hundred members into a real force in the working class movement. And by the first few months of 1907, in the main textile centre of Łódź, is that right, Rick? Yeah. Alone, they had 20,000 members. They had established a mass party which united Polish, German and Jewish workers. And their mass following is confirmed by the fact that in the elections in that time, in the working class curia, the workers voted, you voted on a sort of a class basis. Anyhow, the SDKPIL got 68% of the working class vote in Łódź. Now, in December 1906, the bosses in the textile industry went on the offensive to try to break the working class movement. And in Łódź, they locked out the workers for 20 weeks. And despite extremely bitter street fighting and so on, and despite in the course of the lockout, like I've given those membership figures, but they probably recruited another 30,000 workers in the course of the lockout. Despite all that, the capitalists managed to reassert their control. And after this defeat, the workers' movement began to decline. And that was in turn reinforced by the sheer scale of repression, which was much more intense in Poland than any other part of the Tsarist Empire. From Łódź alone, a city of about 400,000, between January 1908 and October 1909, 10,000 militants were exiled to Siberia. And the SDKPIL was obviously severely weakened by this. And by 1910, it had gone down to about 1,000 members. As for Jasinski, well, I won't go through all his adventures, but there was escape after escape and arrest after arrest. But eventually he was jailed for a longer period, and which he couldn't escape from, in January 1912. And he wasn't free until the February Revolution in Russia. which in the aftermath of that, he was elected to the executive of the Moscow Soviet and to the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party. And he went on, after the October Revolution, to head the Cheka, the Soviet security organization. Okay, so what are we to conclude from all this for us today? Well, firstly, that it's possible in the right circumstances to go from, you know, a relatively small propaganda group and transform that into something approaching a mass working class party. Now, the SDKPIL was able to do this in a very short period of time, and that was partly because of the scale of the upheaval and the radicalisation in Poland in the period of the 1905 revolution, and because Poland did not have an entrenched, you know, reformist trade union and labour movement, which obviously created much more favourable terrain for them. And we have to be clear that in advanced capitalist countries with entrenched labour bureaucracies and reformist political parties, you know, breakthroughs on this sort of scale in such a short period of time are pretty unlikely. You know, in a country with, you know, established reformist and trade union conditions like Australia. Nevertheless, the pattern is nonetheless the case that for Marxist organisations, you know, tend to go through patterns of quite rapid growth when the circumstances are unfavourable and when they can orient correctly, followed by periods of consolidation or often retrenchment and retreat. And so there's no particular reason why this pattern will not is capable of being replicated in the future, provided the Marxists build their organisation on the foundations of strong politics and have a clear understanding of how actually to build, how they can cohere their organisation. The second point, then, is that of the necessity of having a clear and principled political line. Without that, you are building on sand and cannot cohere a cadre. It was the SDKPIL's clarity on the question of the need for working-class unity and opposition to Polish nationalism that gave it a decisive advantage over its reformist rival, the PPS. Of course, an emphasis on polemics and political clarity and so on which, you know, can have its overheads. It can lead to a rigid sectarian approach, which makes the organisation incapable of adapting to shifts in the political situation, to new circumstances. And clearly the SDKPL's violent opposition to Polish nationalism and the extreme form that take would have left it extremely isolated if they'd adhered to that position rigidly in the course of the revolution. However, as I've shown, in practice they were capable of responding to events and adapting. And I think we can say is one of the clear advantages of having a distinctive political worked out, theoretical framework worked out, which you're clear on, which you elaborate, and so on, is that, you know, a clear political position both can be used to train a political cadre around, but also it can be subject to criticism, debate, and modification and correction. You can't do that if you have a fudged, confused position. You can't educate a cadre around fudges and confusions, nor can you build a cadre simply in the abstract by having, you know, a few, you know, abstractly correct ideas plucked out of books. Though, of course, you know, reading books and all that is vital. You can't build a cadre separate from meeting the political challenges, facing up to the political issues that confront you in the here and now, and grappling with them and attempting to go forward on the basis of doing them. Now, to build a revolutionary organisation, you know, always have to answer the question of what to do next. You know, what are the tasks confronting you to building your organisation at any specific point of time? The third point is obviously one of the role of students. You know, throughout its history, and I don't want to labour the point, you know, the SDKPIL, you know, played the vital role of university and high school students in building the organisation. And yet, they were able to build a base in the working class. And contrast that today with, like, you know, in Poland in 1905, students were a tiny minority, incredibly privileged to lead in society, and so on. and they were dealing with a working class, you know, many of whom were illiterate and so on, you know, the devout educational traditions and so on. So a huge gulf separating them. And yet, given the political context and their own commitment to revolutionary politics, they were able to make, you know, extremely important inroads into the working class. You know, if that can be done then, there's no reason why students today, in pretty much all the Western countries, you know, we've been so radically transformed, you know, with a massive, you know, masses of young people going to university, can't also win a base inside the working class. But there is a final point, and I'll wind up, is that political clarity, you know, knowing what you're doing and all that, are very important, but they're far from sufficient. You know, because one of the key reasons that the young revolutionaries of the STKPIL were able to have their successes, were able to build, was because of their determination and commitment, you know, and their deep, you know, rooted commitment to Marxist politics, that meant that they were penally dedicated, prepared to make all sorts of sacrifices and take risks and orientation. Because, as one of the biographers of Dzinski summed him up, I think, you know, the hallmark of Dzinski was not that he was a theoretical leader like Luxembourg and so on, but he was prepared to do everything to fight for the cause. As he wrote, his biographer put it, Dzinski was a thoroughly dedicated party activist, willing to take on any task, no matter how difficult, and use any means at his disposal to promote and defend the cause of revolution. I think the reality, to transform the world, we're going to need many more such comrades. And I'll leave it there.